Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
It's Monday, April 1st, 2002. My name is Jeff Steinberg. Welcome to a very special edition of the LaRouche Connection. With the international financial system crashing at an accelerating rate, with war in the Middle East threatening to blow up the entire clash of civilizations that Lyndon LaRouche has been singularly warning about for the past year, it is no surprise that LaRouche and his associates are once again a subject of widespread discussion and as well of slanders coming out of the circles of Kissinger, Brzezinski, using institutions like the American Family Foundation. And so it's in this context that we have decided to devote this issue of the LaRouche Connection to the airing of a documentary film about the vicious campaign waged during the 1980s and early 90s to throw LaRouche and many of his colleagues in jail in an attempt to destroy the political movement. We call this special segment of the LaRouche Connection, The Man in the Iron Mask.
It is now early 1991. In the past 2 years, in the nations formerly behind the Iron Curtain and elsewhere, peaceful revolutions freed political prisoners. Some today are the leaders of those nations. In the United States, there are political prisoners. As former Attorney General Ramsey Clark told the International Helsinki Conference on Human Rights in July of last year, the most well-known of those political prisoners is Lyndon LaRouche, economist and opposition political leader, who forecast the ongoing bank collapse and economic depression in the United States. For George Bush and Henry Kissinger, masters of Washington at the moment, Lyndon LaRouche is their man in the iron mask.
This detailed warning of the war in the Persian Gulf was issued 2 months before Iraq invaded Kuwait. The warning was made from a federal prison cell in Minnesota. The newspaper of Lyndon LaRouche's political movement published it July 13. But the warning on which this article was based had been made by Lyndon LaRouche in June, and his associates had circulated it throughout the United States, the Mideast, and Europe by July 13th. In 1990, even after 18 months in jail, LaRouche's warning that Bush, Kissinger, and Moscow all wanted a Mideast war drew a response from his opponents and enemies in the United States. LaRouche had been the only Western political leader to insist, through more than 15 years of investigation, prosecutions, and threats against him, from Henry Kissinger and the Anti-Defamation League, that only a kind of Marshall Plan of economic development would solve the disastrous political conflicts of the Middle East. Lyndon LaRouche, warning of the war George Bush would start, had been jailed in the very week that Bush was inaugurated president. While campaigning for presidents earlier, George Bush had said,
"Lyndon LaRouche is in a lot of trouble, and he deserves to be in a lot of trouble."
LaRouche had been prosecuted by a federal, multi-state, multi-agency task force with unprecedented expenditure of money, effort, and pre-prosecution media attacks. Virginia Attorney General Mary Sue Terry outlined its methods in a press conference following this raid.
"The full resources of each office will be available to every other office. We will provide not only technical and legal assistance to one another, but special prosecutors as well. You will see federal prosecutors in state courts, and you will see assistant attorneys general in state and federal courts. This will make the whole of the prosecution team stronger than the sum of its parts, and bring the full resources of all our efforts to bear on any particular LaRouche case."
Those full resources brought to bear on the LaRouche case are, as Terry said, massive. 9 federal departments and federal agencies, 9 state attorneys general, and state police agencies, police and intelligence agencies of at least 3 foreign countries, combined with massive media vilification and attacks by private political enemies of LaRouche, fusing the meaningless words political extremist together with the name Lyndon LaRouche somewhere in the political consciousness of virtually every American. LaRouche has said,
"It's a matter of legal record that the prosecution and persecution against me and my friends was initiated by the circles of Henry A. Kissinger, former Secretary of State."
Over the past decade, evidence released by the United States government has increasingly proven this charge against Kissinger and his friends. Evidence like these 1982 letters about LaRouche from Kissinger to FBI Director William Webster. And this testimony in a recent trial of LaRouche associates in Roanoke, Virginia, by Richard Morris. Morris was the chief aide to President Reagan's National Security Advisor, William Clark.
"Mr. Morris, you stated that you had received criticism from a group of people in the National Security Council who were connected with intelligence as a result of meetings between yourself and Mr. LaRouche and representatives of Mr. LaRouche's movement. Is that correct?"
"Yes."
"To your knowledge, were you the only member of the NSC who was subject to such criticism?"
"No, others were also."
"Did this have to do with Henry Kissinger?"
"In 1983, the president appointed a commission called the Kissinger Commission, whose duties were to determine issues that were important to our national security as they existed in Central America. The staff's support was headed by Oliver North."
"Did Mr. LaRouche or his associates ever provide you information critical of Mr. Kissinger and Mr. Kissinger's policies?"
"Yes, often."
"As a result of your testimony for the defense in these cases, have you been subject to criticism which you understood to be directed at your involvement as a witness?"
"Yes. Yes, I have."
This photograph is of the late Edward Bennett Williams, Henry Kissinger's lawyer and fellow member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Williams had told a reporter in the 1980s that members of that board were out to stop LaRouche.
"LaRouche is a real menace. I'm going to have dinner with Henry Kissinger next week, and I'm going to talk to him about this whole thing, because I believe the opportunity is now surfacing for us. LaRouche and his gang are about to be indicted up there in Massachusetts on this credit card business. I talked to Bill Weld, who is the U.S. attorney up there, yesterday for a long time. We're going to nail LaRouche to the boards."
LaRouche was sent to prison while making strong warnings of disasters looming during the Kissinger-dominated presidency of George Bush. These were the most public possible warnings. Some were printed for mass distribution during the presidential campaign in 1987 and 1988. Some were published as advertisements in the United States' leading daily newspapers. Some were delivered in primetime political broadcasts on national television.
"The economy of the Soviet bloc itself is a terrible and worsening failure. In Western European culture, we have demonstrated that the success of nations of big industries depends upon the technologically progressive independent farmer and what is called here in Germany the Mittelstand. Soviet culture in its present form is not capable of applying this lesson. Despite all attempts at structural reform, and despite any amount of credit supplied by the foolish West, the Soviet bloc economy as a whole has reached the critical point. Under the proper conditions, many today will agree that the time has come for early steps toward the reunification of Germany, with the obvious prospect that Berlin might resume its role as the nation's capital."
LaRouche made that forecast of German unification in Berlin on October 12, 1988, 2 years before that unification was achieved, and 1 year before anything was stirring in East Germany. His campaign committee paid to have it broadcast on national television in the United States. 2 days later, LaRouche, who was a candidate for the presidency with the election just weeks away, was indicted in Alexandria, Virginia on conspiracy charges with great publicity. He had already been tried once in Boston federal court, and the charges against him were about to be dismissed, but the second trial would shortly send LaRouche to prison. LaRouche's forecasts for the United States in the period of the Bush presidency were not hopeful, unless Bush dramatically reversed his banking and economic policies, but they were just as public. Here is what he warned.
Coming generations will remember President George Bush for the worst crises to have struck these United States since more than 100 years. Among these earth-shaking crises will be the deepest worldwide financial collapse of this century. As long as the official line of the administration is to stick to the economic policies of the past 5 years, this would turn the Venice summit into a disaster, destroying the last bit of confidence in the U.S. dollar in international financial markets. Under those conditions, an October crash would be very probable.
Does George Bush know that the man who warned that his presidency would be remembered for the worst crises to have struck these United States for more than 100 years is sitting in jail, his entire movement under continual prosecutorial attack and threat of political elimination? Well, on the campaign trail, and as early as July 31, 1987, Bush declared,
"I don't like the things LaRouche does. He's bilked people out of lots of money and misrepresented what causes money was going to. LaRouche deserves to be in a lot of trouble."
This was the same George Bush who, when asked to comment on Oliver North's trial, said,
"He's entitled to the right of appeal without a lot of editorial comment from me. I won't comment on the matter until after the appeal is exhausted."
The same George Bush who asked to comment on John Poindexter's trial said through a spokesman,
"I can rule out having any comment on this matter while the case is on appeal."
In LaRouche's case, however, George Bush's public comments did not even wait for the trial to begin. And there is more to this. For the 2 years since LaRouche's rocket docket trial and conviction in federal court in 1988, his attorneys have repeatedly asked the White House to release 4,700 pages of classified FBI files on LaRouche. The proven existence of these files led to the dismissal of the charges in the earlier trial of LaRouche in Boston, and his attorneys maintained that they would lead to a new trial for him now. The FBI acknowledges that the files exist. President George Bush has refused to release them. Years ago, a novel by Alexandre Dumas became a well-known film, The Man in the Iron Mask. The story told was of a king of France who imprisoned the legitimate king, his brother and opponent. He was put in a dungeon, cut off from all human contact, and fixed with a terrible iron mask to prevent anyone from recognizing him. Eventually, a courageous circle of oppositionists freed the prisoner to take the throne, putting the usurper in his place in prison. Lyndon LaRouche is George Bush's and Henry Kissinger's man in the iron mask.
Now, let us go back much further to 1983. To look for the origin of this legal political assault on LaRouche. We now know, thanks to trial testimony and prosecutions against LaRouche associates, that the Get LaRouche networks planned their campaign against him at two extraordinary meetings in 1983 at this luxury office building in Manhattan. The meetings took place in the offices of John Train, New York investment banker and cousin of World Wildlife Fund head Russell Train, from a family which has long combined banking and international intelligence work. Train, with many friends and contacts both in British intelligence and in Kissinger circles, volunteered to pull together Get LaRouche planning sessions of both government and private enemies of the candidate, Attending those meetings, among others, were the ADL's Mira Lansky-Boland, representing the ADL fact-finding division chief Irwin Sewell, two Kissinger-linked officials of the National Security Council, Roy Godson and Walter Raymond, banker Richard Mellon Scaife and his hired intelligence agent, John Reese, and selected anti-LaRouche journalists, including Pat Lynch, Dennis King, and others, from the Wall Street Journal to High Times. Here is the actual chart prepared for the meeting of Get LaRouche conspirators. It is a profile of LaRouche's movement, its finances, and its personnel. The objective of John Train's first anti-LaRouche soiree in 1983 was to begin the process of destroying that LaRouche movement. Starting with targeted but brutal media bombardment against the candidate and his associates, these meetings resulted from a financial establishment freakout at the demonstrated influence LaRouche had on the first Ronald Reagan administration, which had just been shown by the president's announcement of the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars. This new defense doctrine had been discussed in the National Security Council on the basis of Lyndon LaRouche's anti-ballistic missile defense proposals of 1981 and 1982, and the conspirators knew it. National Security Council official Richard Morris has testified that the two men on the council most determined to destroy LaRouche's influence there in 1983 were Roy Godson and Walter Raymond, the same two NSC officials attending the Get LaRouche planning meeting in banker John Train's apartment. Godson and Raymond were Kissinger men, as was John Train. Raymond ran so-called Project Democracy operations of the National Security Council. Both he and Godson were deeply involved in the Contra policy and implementing other of the secret government operations associated with Kissinger's circles in the Reagan administration. LaRouche was their opposition, as Richard Morris confirmed on the stand in Roanoke 7 years later in 1990. Following the Train meetings, the targeted media attacks on LaRouche began immediately on NBC TV's Nightly News and First Camera, in the New Republic, in the Washington Post, and in the Soviet government's publications. The theme was always the same, whether the media were based in New York, Washington, or Moscow. The Reagan White House must break all connections with Lyndon LaRouche. This was, above all, Henry Kissinger's demand. Kissinger told the authors of the New Republic slander of LaRouche that the LaRouche influence in the Reagan administration was
outrageous, stupid, and nearly unforgivable.
Beginning in 1982, Kissinger had written at least two letters about LaRouche to FBI Director William Webster. The first showed that Kissinger was, in fact, pushing his pal Bill to go after LaRouche. The second was far more detailed and urgent.
We may be witnessing here not normal radical political action, but a systematic and disinformation campaign supported by some foreign intelligence services. I therefore request an investigation to ascertain whether the foregoing activities violate federal law.
A January 12, 1983 memo from FBI Director William Webster to Deputy Director Oliver Revelle shows that orders to investigate LaRouche came from Kissinger's buddies on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. In 1981, LaRouche's enemies convinced President Reagan to sign several executive orders, mechanisms through which the president can create new agencies without any prior approval from Congress. Executive Order 12331 created the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Executive Order 12333 created the Iran-Contra apparatus of Oliver North. Executive Order 12334 created the President's Foreign Intelligence Oversight Board. This entire apparatus was overseen by the Special Situation Group headed by George Bush.
During 1982, LaRouche's meetings with India's Prime Minister Indira Gandhi and with Mexico's President López Portillo on the subject of foreign debt versus development for South America and the entire Third World infuriated Kissinger's entire circle.
In May of 1982, LaRouche traveled to Mexico in the midst of the worst crisis the world financial system had seen since the 30s. Mexico had incurred huge debts during the 1970s, trying to build up its industrial base on the premise that its huge oil reserves would allow it to repay. When the price of oil collapsed, so did Mexico's ability to service its loans. International bankers were staring at a potential $100 billion default. Mexico's rich funneled dollars out of the country as rapidly as they could, fueling the crisis as the capital flight eroded further Mexico's ability to pay. In his meeting with López Portillo, LaRouche discussed his proposed reforms of the world financial system and how Mexico could take certain measures during the crisis to force these reforms into discussion. 4 months later, López Portillo shocked the world by adopting many of the reforms LaRouche had proposed. He was supported by his people as 1 million Mexicans rallied in defense of the measures 2 days later. Long-standing operations against LaRouche by both private and quasi-governmental organizations suddenly took on new energy. The apparatus used were the institutions established under Reagan's executive orders.
LaRouche foresaw that Kissinger's Central America policy, then being adopted by the Reagan administration, would lead to North-South war, first against Latin America, then against the entire Third World. LaRouche broadcast his views on national television as a candidate.
Like the Nazi regime during World War II, the world's most powerful international and financial agencies today have targeted between 120 and 150 million black Africans for death through genocide, death by famine and epidemic. This mass murder is the policy of influential institutions such as the Club of Rome, which claims that regions such as black Africa are overpopulated and the world's population must be reduced by such methods. The evil policies the Club of Rome are being implemented by powerful banking institutions of Switzerland, by the International Monetary Fund, by the World Bank. These are policies endorsed by high officials of our own Federal Reserve System. These are policies being put into effect in many parts of the world by Henry A. Kissinger and his friends.
The Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board demanded LaRouche be dealt with.
Early in 1984, with LaRouche, the presidential candidate, purchasing half-hour network political broadcasts to attack Kissinger Republicans and Mondale Democrats, Kissinger told a reporter, "I'll take care of LaRouche after the primary elections." And that is exactly when Boston United States Attorney William Weld moved against LaRouche, calling with great publicity his first grand jury, which sat for 15 months from late 1984 until early 1986 with no indictments. What Henry Kissinger and William Weld did get from that first grand jury, however, was financial warfare. The chief FBI agent working with Weld was able to get LaRouche movement accounts frozen in many banks, including accounts of LaRouche's presidential campaign committees during the final week of the campaign. The Federal Election Commission quickly joined in, refusing to disperse matching funds owed the campaign, which were to be used to repay its lenders and debts. Second, Weld got contempt fines against each of the three main publishing companies associated with the LaRouche movement. These contempt fines were the first wedge into the LaRouche movement's finances, which Henry Kissinger had been demanding since 1982. The fines were huge, $10,000 per day for each company, finally totaling nearly $20 million. The fines continued to mount even after the grand jury dissolved and there was nothing for the companies to be in contempt of. Later, these contempt fines were the federal government's hook for its unprecedented and illegal action to force bankruptcy liquidation of these publishing companies.
Now, let us go forward to 1986, when the task force attack on LaRouche was escalated in an astounding manner as a result, as we shall see, of the dramatic success of LaRouche's political movement.
The complete legal railroading of Lyndon LaRouche was intensively prepared by the entire American mass media during 1986. The year began with the first major election victories by the LaRouche candidates' movement and ended with the spectacular October 1986 government raids, which then led to the unprecedented and illegal forced bankruptcy of the publishing companies of LaRouche's political movement. From 1982, Lyndon LaRouche had launched a candidates' movement of citizens publicly backing his policies by running for office on LaRouche slates, usually in Democratic Party primaries. The LaRouche Democrats gathered a consistently growing grassroots vote as the real economy declined. Today, the LaRouche vote still stands up, even after a decade of legal and media attacks. In March 1986 in Illinois, the LaRouche vote broke the threshold of statewide primary victories for the first time. For 7 months, until October 1986, there was constant vilification, a spectacular trial by press. Court testimony by a researcher who collected and filed these articles established that in those 7 months, at least 15,000 newspaper articles, more than 60 per day, 7 days a week, covered the United States with attacks on LaRouche and his movement. All but one or two, the researcher testified, were totally negative attacks. Magazines, TV, and radio, of course, joined in. Every American was affected. For years, repeating political extremist on hearing Lyndon LaRouche's name without even knowing what the phrase meant.
Because I think they're scared to death of Lyndon LaRouche.
There was a second result of that stunning LaRouche victory in Illinois in March 1986. William Weld quickly reconvened his Boston grand jury, which had been disbanded after 15 months of failing to indict LaRouche. The national leaders of the Democratic Party held an emergency press conference in New York State. The national chairman of the party, its best-known governor, its state chairman, a well-known senator, and others, to say,
"We call on state chairmen to keep LaRouche candidates off primary ballots, using all political, legal, or other means."
In May, ADL official Stuart Lockman boasted that
ADL is clearly identified as the opponent of the LaRoucheites, and virtually all of the public exposure of that group is either ADL produced or generated.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
Meanwhile, NBC-TV's Pat Lynch, combined with Irwin Sewell of the Anti-Defamation League's so-called fact-finding division, in an incredible new televised slander. The charge that LaRouche had masterminded the 1986 assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. Lynch herself contacted the Swedish police to offer them evidence of this claim, which they later ridiculed. Sewell and Lynch were joining a Soviet government campaign.
Они не забывают и о розовых. Послушайте, что говорит их лидер Ларуш.
A half-hour film was produced for Soviet TV in 1986 and had an actor portraying LaRouche order the killing of Palme. Gorbachev's supporters in the Soviet hierarchy conducted a parallel campaign of vilification of LaRouche, which had begun after the announcement of the Strategic Defense Initiative by President Reagan in 1983 and stretched until the raid on LaRouche's Leesburg headquarters in late 1986. During that time, 14 major articles and series attacking LaRouche appeared in Soviet government publications. Izvestia, for example, in March 1984, raged against LaRouche.
The scandalous ties of the Reagan administration with LaRouche were exposed in a special report of NBC television. Their proofs were so weighty that the White House did not even try to deny them. The admission of the White House not only reveals LaRouche's true face, but also shows that the current Washington administration is not adverse to using the services of provocateurs and neo-fascists.
By 1986, the Soviet attacks were running for 3,000 words.
Clearly, Mr. LaRouche provides the feedback for dyed-in-the-wool fascists who do not know what to do with themselves and are ready for anything, assassinations included.
So both sides of the so-called New World Order, the backers of Gorbachev and the Western circles of Henry Kissinger, vilified LaRouche throughout the 1980s and openly supported each other in doing so.
October 1986. The first summit between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev took place at Reykjavik, Iceland.
On the eve of that summit, a Soviet KGB publication ran a highly unusual article about Lyndon LaRouche, calling for LaRouche to be immediately investigated and prosecuted in the United States. The publication is Sovietskaya Kultura. The title refers to LaRouche as, quote, provocateur aspiring to become president. The article demands, how is it possible that the LaRoucheites act so openly? Why isn't the Internal Revenue Service interested in the affairs of a man who receives millions of dollars from publications and in the form of contributions, but has not paid any taxes? Just what information has the Reagan administration received from him? October 1986. The Iran-Contra scandal blew open with the shooting down of the plane of Eugene Hassenfuss. A little-known Beirut publication revealed that a high-ranking American delegation led by National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane had visited Tehran, Iran that May to negotiate for the release of the hostages and arms to Khomeini. What was out in full public view was, in the words of the head of the U.S. Senate's Intelligence Committee, David Boren, the secret parallel government of the United States. This secret government, which illegally supplied the Contras with weapons paid for by drugs and by arms sales to Iran, had an enemies list which included all critics of Contra support. The most dangerous was LaRouche. This telex from General Richard Secord to Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North was one of an unknown number of such actions targeting LaRouche. Here is another in which Colonel North urges the entire White House to ignore LaRouche's policy reports. And here, the continual pressure of Kissinger's friends in the Anti-Defamation League. October 1986, the Northern Virginia town of Leesburg, where LaRouche's movement had its national publishing headquarters, was visited by an unprecedented military-style invasion launched in the pre-dawn hours, with a search force which was bigger per capita than that used in the invasion of Grenada. A federal state Get LaRouche prosecutorial task force was executing search warrants, as their press releases put it, with over 400 officers of the FBI, the Secret Service, the Internal Revenue Service, and the Virginia State Police, among others. Many were armed with automatic weapons, others with axes and sledgehammers, and backed by armored personnel carriers and helicopters. All this to search parts of two small office buildings, deserted at that hour of the morning, and to arrest five people who made no resistance at their homes. Property nearby on which LaRouche lived was surrounded with armed officers and squad cars, and an assault was threatened, although no warrant existed for LaRouche or anyone else there. 435 boxes, 75% of the movement's documents, were carried away to a federal warehouse, whereas Virginia Attorney General Mary Souterry stated, the state of Virginia would determine not whether a prosecution would be brought, but what individuals should be prosecuted and on what charges. But the man who ordered this massive attempt to shut down the LaRouche movement in October 1986 was now head of the criminal division of the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., William Weld, scion of the White Weld investment banking family. LaRouche had formerly publicly accused Weld of covering up large-scale criminal drug money laundering by large New England banks linked to that of Weld's own family. Back in January 1986, a memo from William Weld, then U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, to U.S. attorneys and state attorney generals all over the country, had announced that his Boston office and the Secret Service were coordinating a national conference in Boston on February 12th to 14th, 1986, to get a prosecution of fundraising fraud against LaRouche.
William Weld is extremely interested in this case and has encouraged other U.S. attorneys across the country to develop their own cases.
Weld had failed to convince his own grand jury for 15 months, but in June 1986, he called a new one. Then, in September, just weeks before the spectacular raid on LaRouche's headquarters would take place, William Weld was appointed head of the criminal division of the Justice Department, its third-ranking official. According to the October 7, 1986 Washington Post, Weld galvanized Justice and FBI officials in Washington about the LaRouche case. Weld just threw a hand grenade into the DOJ, one law enforcement source said. The feeling was, let's hit him. For 2 years following that month of October 1986, the establishment press trumpeted such claims as the end of the Cold War, the peace dividend, and a soft landing for the U.S. economy. Reagan prepared to give power over to George Bush. LaRouche alone challenged all these miscalculations, which were otherwise universally believed. Obviously, these voices, Executive Intelligence Review, LaRouche's newspaper, LaRouche himself, were obstacles to the New World Order. Blow after blow was directed at LaRouche and his movement by the Get LaRouche Task Force. In November 1986, there were more raids, this time in California, where the movement had its most influential state organization. In February 1987, indictments were issued against 16 fundraisers and 5 publishing corporations of the movement by the state of Virginia. Virginia Attorney General Mary Sue Terry announces she will immediately shut these organizations down. In March 1987, overlapping indictments of many of the same fundraisers and corporations by New York State Attorney General Robert Abrams, who had been represented at the press conference at which national officials of the Democratic Party the previous year had called for stopping LaRouche by legal, political, or other means. In April 1987, an incredible escalation. The federal government, acting as a sole creditor, secretly seized under bankruptcy law the main publishing companies of the movement, terminating its primary political newspaper and magazines. The action was unprecedented in U.S. legal history. 2.5 years later, it was ruled illegal and in bad faith by a bankruptcy judge who accused U.S. Attorney Henry Hudson of constructive fraud upon his court. A federal judge confirmed the bankruptcy judge's finding completely on appeal. But in that April of 1987, most of the movement's offices around the country were seized and shut by that illegal government action, and stayed seized and shut until the publications and the publishing corporations were defunct. In June 1987, LaRouche himself was indicted, along with 9 other leaders of the movement, for trial by federal prosecutors in Boston. In January 1988, California activists for LaRouche were indicted on absurd charges, later dropped, of fraud in petitioning for a ballot initiative referendum. All during 1988, LaRouche and his leading associates were on trial in Boston. When that prosecution failed, they were re-indicted by federal prosecutors in Alexandria, Virginia, the federal court circuit known as the Rocket Docket, for its extreme speed and efficiency in convicting defendants or forcing them into hurried guilty pleas to avoid the railroad ride. This time, LaRouche was indicted, tried, and convicted, all within a 2-month period from indictment to conviction, despite an extremely complex indictment involving 7 defendants and potentially millions of documents. Meanwhile, Despite the dismissal of the charges in the Boston case, FBI case agent Richard Egan destroyed tens of thousands of the LaRouche movement's documents, which had been subpoenaed for that case. Some of these prosecutions were dismissed, some mistried, but the Get LaRouche prosecutorial task force kept piling them on, while the financial establishment's Get LaRouche press made crystal clear that the real objective of this task force was to stop LaRouche movement's political activity. LaRouche, 68 years old and confined in a federal prison, today performs physical labor. When prison officials tried to force LaRouche back to work just one day after major surgery in 1989, thousands worldwide protested. The Bureau of Prisons granted LaRouche a brief medical leave from work. Early in 1990, the Department of Justice showed that LaRouche is a politically targeted prisoner when the Bureau of Prisons was sent this sentencing memo by Assistant U.S. Attorney Kent Robinson, who had prosecuted LaRouche for Henry Hudson of Alexandria.
I cannot dispute the absence of prior convictions against these defendants, but this is not a typical crime and these are not typical defendants. Accordingly, this case presents extraordinary circumstances calling for the commission to arrive at a release date outside the guidelines. Whatever range the commission employs, the release date arrived at should be at the highest end of the applicable range. Society has the right to be protected from these defendants.
Meanwhile, what happened to Kissinger's secret government men, the Iran-Contra warriors who broke the law on orders of the Kissinger Commission and the National Security Council? Their operations were exposed first in October 1986 in a jungle press conference by captured U.S. pilot Eugene Hassenfuss, just as LaRouche's movement was being raided and shut down by a massive federal and state task force deployment. In September 1988, another former CIA contract pilot, Richard Brennecke, testified under oath at the trial of a colleague. Brennecke testified that George Bush himself, together with Richard Allen and William Casey, had met in late 1980 with representatives of Ayatollah Khomeini to persuade them not to release the American hostages before the November 1980 presidential elections and thus ensure the defeat of Jimmy Carter. In May 1989, President Bush had Brennecke indicted for perjury. An Oregon jury found Brennecke innocent. On February 11, 1987, U.S. Senator John Kerry's investigator testified to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the Contras moved drugs not by the pound, not by the bag, but by the ton, by the cargo plane load. Leon B. Kellner, Miami's U.S. attorney, complained that everybody he indicted on big drug charges argued that they were running drugs as part of a sanctioned operation to supply the Contras with arms. In March 1986, the San Francisco Examiner reported that the U.S. attorney there actually returned $35,000 that a drug runner argued belonged to the Contra Revolution. What were the LaRouche trials? What makes him a political prisoner? It leaps out in the first instance from the filing of LaRouche's appeal itself. In an unprecedented action, more than 800 attorneys from the United States, many of considerable prominence, and 100 more from other nations, joined as friends of the court in LaRouche's appeal. They included 35 heads of bar associations, half a dozen law school deans, former judges, congressmen, U.S. attorneys, and state attorneys general. Most had not known LaRouche in any connection until they heard and read materials from his trial. Their statements said,
"The trial judge denied any semblance of a fair trial in this case, rushed the appellants to trial without adequate time to prepare, denied them the right to a fair and impartial jury, and excluded essential areas of evidence which were critical to the defense case. The precedent set by the district court's actions in this case, if allowed to stand, would represent a serious erosion of the right to fair trial for any accused, particularly an accused surrounded by controversy and publicity. It would represent a dangerous erosion of the fundamental rights guaranteed by our Constitution and Bill of Rights."
Yet the Supreme Court of the United States refused even to hear the LaRouche appeal. In the Third World, the opinion was even more strongly held. These 100 members of Congress of the nations of Central and South America placed an advertisement in a Washington, D.C. newspaper protesting the LaRouche conviction. LaRouche's appeals lawyer is former United States Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who knew and has opposed the practice of targeted prosecutions of individuals or groups by special prosecutorial task forces. Speaking to the Copenhagen meeting of the 35-nation Conference of Security and Cooperation in Europe last year, Clark said,
"A massive propaganda campaign against Lyndon LaRouche was done over a period of many, many years. Nazi, anti-Semitic, violence-prone, thief, over and over again, vilification. LaRouche was indicted just 3 weeks before the 1988 presidential elections. He was on the ballot. I was in the Department of Justice for 8 years. We never indicted a political figure before an election."
In Boston, there was a political show trial which demonstrated extensive government infiltration, subversion, and misconduct against LaRouche's movement. 4,700 pages of classified intelligence agency documents on LaRouche and his associates were admitted to exist during the proceedings. When the case mistried, the judge found institutional and systemic prosecutorial misconduct had occurred during the trial, and the jury said,
"We would have acquitted everyone at this point, and that's based on the prosecution's evidence. There was too much evidence of government misconduct in what was happening in the LaRouche campaign."
Then the federal prosecutors made minor changes in the charges against LaRouche and simply reindicted and retried him in the Federal Circuit of Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., the notorious Rocket Docket. As Attorney General Clark said, LaRouche, if anyone ever was rushed to trial. In the 29 days from indictment to trial, 5 of the 7 defense lawyers repeatedly protested to the judge that they did not have time to prepare their clients' cases or even to learn what the masses of documents involved were about. All evidence of government infiltration and harassment, precisely what had decided the case for the Boston jurors, was ruled out by Alexandria trial judge Albert Bryan Jr.
That the government was the creditor that initiated the involuntary bankruptcy proceeding will not be admitted because the court concludes that this would divert the jury from the issues raised by the indictment.
Jury selection, conducted entirely by the judge, took 72 minutes. The jury foreman was a high security clearance government official who was assigned to crisis emergency government task forces set up to implement suspension of the U.S. Constitution in case of national, economic, or military emergency, part of the secret parallel government apparatus itself. The Alexandria judge, Albert V. Bryan Jr., is from the family which owns and controls InterArms, the world's largest private arms dealer. He is an insider in the secret government operations of the National Security Council since Henry Kissinger ran it directly during the Nixon administration. In other words, Judge Bryan was a political opponent of LaRouche. Bryan is one of 7 judges of the government's secret National Security Court, which decides such questions as the declassification of secret documents for trials. Bryan had also previously ruled that the government's forced bankruptcy was legal. He then prohibited LaRouche's defense attorneys from bringing it up in the criminal trial proceedings.
Chief Judge Albert V. Bryan Jr. finally accomplished in January 1989 what the entire federal multi-state task force, the media, the Anti-Defamation League, and Kissinger's circles of influence had been trying to do since 1982, railroad LaRouche to jail. That job done, Bryan taunted Boston federal Judge Keaton.
"I should at least get a cigar from Judge Keaton for doing his work for him. I haven't even gotten that. You need not put that in the record."
That these prosecutions were based on novel legal theories was acknowledged by prosecution and press. No other political party or movement has ever been prosecuted in criminal courts
for failure to repay political loans, even though such failure has been common for decades. The Virginia State Securities Commission found the LaRouche movement's political loans to be securities only after the state had arrested LaRouche fundraisers for securities fraud and pressured the commission to fall in line. When there was still no commission ruling on the loans even after the indictments, it was clear that due process had been violated, even to the media in the capital of Richmond.
Investigators close to the LaRouche case say they are stunned by the delay. Depending on what the commission does, the entire case, including the felony cases, could be down the tubes, one investigator said.
Government prosecutors acknowledged in Virginia that these novel theories came in part from LaRouche's private sector political enemies, most particularly the Anti-Defamation League. Virginia prosecutor John Russell stipulated in court during a pretrial hearing on the selective character of the prosecutions that ADL officials, quote, bore an animus against LaRouche's organization and that they had their nose in every one of these prosecutions. The ADL's involvement went far beyond Russell's generalities. It included an open attempt proven in Roanoke to suborn and bribe the judge, Clifford R. Weckstein, who had LaRouche Associates on trial before him. ADL officials exchanged correspondence with Weckstein, including at least 10 letters while the trial was underway. When revealed, they made clear that Weckstein had himself initiated the correspondence. The subject was LaRouche and his movement. In this letter, Weckstein is sent ADL slanders on LaRouche and an enclosure which implies that a state Supreme Court judgeship could be open to Weckstein as a result of ADL activity. During a Virginia pretrial hearing, LaRouche on the witness stand and prosecutor Russell battled over the ADL.
You criticized the ADL for trying to use government agencies to effectuate their aim, which you believe is to destroy you. Is that correct?
No. I say the ADL is out to destroy me for reasons which I ultimately do not try to explain, and that the ADL has become improperly an integral part of a national Get LaRouche strike force, and that all, rather than that the ADL is the problem, what I'm complaining is that the government itself, the prosecution of a multi-agency federal state private task force, has allowed itself to become perversely used and thoroughly corrupted by its association with the ADL. That the government, mind you, I'm not talking about, you're asking my view of this matter. My view is that the government, including you yourself, of course, should know and should have known the animus of the ADL against me and my friends. And under those circumstances, should not have allowed yourselves, I'm speaking to you as a member of a federal multi-state strike force, should not have allowed yourself to be associated with the ADL in framing investigations to be presented before a grand jury, in bringing indictments, in prosecuting indictments, in conditioning and preparing witnesses, and so forth and so on, that you and your associates in the National Strike Force are corrupt and do not belong in government if you do the kind of thing, establish the kind of relationship with the ADL you've established for this and related cases. That's what my understanding of the matter is.
You are directing a campaign right now that is specifically aimed at the destruction of the ADL.
No, we're aiming a campaign at the dissolution of a corrupt strike force of which you serve personally or are a member.
And for the exoneration of defendants who've been unjustly victimized by this corrupt action.
The ADL's Judge Weckstein completely protected this Get LaRouche task force from exposure to the jury, despite the most energetic attempts of defense lawyers to bring the task force nature of the prosecution to the light of day. Virtually every Get LaRouche operative we have discussed was subpoenaed to testify by defense lawyers for LaRouche's associates. Banker John Train, ADL officials Irwin Sewell and Mira Boland, government insiders Oliver North, Roy Godson, Richard Secord, Walter Raymond, Henry Kissinger, NBC producer Pat Lynch, prosecutors Henry Hudson, John Markham, FBI agent Richard Egan, and others. Each and every subpoena was denied, or if issued, was then quashed by Judge Weckstein.
Only weeks ago, on March 1, 1991, the United Nations Human Rights Commission in Geneva put out this press release on international cases of human rights violations. They had heard a presentation on LaRouche's case by Warren J. Hammerman, who has been leading the fight for his release. Hammerman's presentation had generated great interest, in particular from delegations representing third world countries. The international call for justice for LaRouche is getting louder.
This case now belongs to the Jury of Nations and to citizens of the United States, where justice for those politically targeted has been eliminated, where a greater portion of the population is in jail than in the Soviet Union or South Africa, where the path toward police state conditions has been tracked by the denial of a fair trial and appeal to Lyndon LaRouche.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements. Thank you.